Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the pilot episode of You Like Hoops on the Grizzly Bear Blues Podcast Network. I'm Chase Lucas. I will be your host. With this being the first episode, I'm going to start off with a little bit of introduction and a little bit of an explanation of what this podcast probably will be, might be, kind of what the idea behind it is, and then we'll go ahead and bring in our first guest. So basically, I listen to a lot of podcasts, basketball and otherwise, everything from political to movie and television criticism and comedy podcasts. And probably my favorite format just to listen to is employed by a lot of the comedy podcasts. And that's essentially an interview show that just focuses on more of an open conversation, broader themes, not necessarily, you know, what's up in the news. So like this podcast will not be the place you want to come to hear about what happened with the Grizzlies last night. You know, whether Fizdale's defense is tailored to the personnel he has here versus what he had in Miami, you know, what the Grizzlies can do to find a combo guard to put next to Mike Conley, what kind of player is best suited to play next to Mike Conley, all that stuff that, you know, more hardcore or drier analysis. There's tons of great podcasts out there. Some of them appear on this network. You'll hear people having those discussions. That's just not our goal for this podcast. A good example, I was talking about those comedy podcasts I like to listen to that use this format. One example might be You Made It Weird by Pete Holmes, which is a really good podcast if you're into that sort of thing. But one thing I like about that that will be mostly true of the podcast is that I remember when I first found that, it was a couple years into it, and what I was able to do is to go back and look through the back catalog and see, are there other people who might interest me that I could listen to their episode? Because one thing about that podcast, and will also be true of this one, the rotating guest every week. So with a rotating guest every week and with it not being necessarily time sensitive in terms of information, you can kind of go back through, even if you've missed years worth of episodes in my case, and you can pick and choose ones you might want to listen to. And you'll hear some things that will probably tie it to a certain time, but it's not going to make you feel totally out of place or like, you know, nothing that you're hearing has value any longer. I mean, you know, for instance, the political podcasts I listen to, especially in the current landscape, if it sits in my app for more than a couple of days, all of a sudden it feels dated and I'm more apt to probably just delete it and wait for the next episode to come out. So that's kind of the format we'll be going with. You know, when you're making a pro-con list, definitely the con of this type of podcast is if you're not careful, and even if you are, maybe it can veer into self-indulgence. So if you're sitting there thinking, hey, why would I care about the personal life or the opinions on anything other than what's happening on the court of, you know, some blogger or media person or radio host or whatever type of person we might have on here? And if that's you, I get it. This podcast may not be so much for you. You might not enjoy it so much. For me, I just find that sort of our life experiences and biases to a degree, they inform the way that we come at pretty much everything. And even something as trivial as basketball or movies, TV, all that stuff, you know, our experiences and how we think about things, they influence the way we process information. And like I said, that can include fandom and basketball. So I think it's interesting to know a little bit about people. I enjoy listening to people kind of talk about themselves, honestly. And so that's a little bit of what we're going to do here. But with all that out of the way, and like I said, it is a pilot episode. So things will change and evolve, and some pilot episodes of television shows, for example, are really fully formed and you know what you're getting from episode one, and others are maybe like Parks and Rec where the characters are unrecognizable by season two. And so a lot of things will probably change. We'll maybe get some sound updates. We'll get some music plugged in. But for now, we're just kind of figuring things out. So we appreciate you sticking with us while we work out the kinks. And with all of that said, I'm going to go ahead and bring in our first guest, Joe Mullinax, who is the site manager at Grizzly Bear Blues. Joe, did any of that sound familiar maybe from when we recorded this last night?
I don't remember recording anything last night, but it is strange. It was like a dream. You know, you're kind of in a strange place where you're reaching out for something and it sounds like, oh my goodness, I've heard that before, a little deja vu. No, technical difficulties happen, and you know, I'm passionate about the podcast expanding over at Grizzly Bear Blues, and I'm excited that you're taking the reins on this and making it your baby, so to speak. And I am more than willing to invest the time necessary to make sure that we get this show off on the right foot, and I'm excited to be on the program with you, Chase.
Awesome. Yeah, for the listener, as we mentioned on Twitter, and I kind of alluded to in the intro, we recorded at least a version of this last night. We've already got some new topics to talk about that we didn't talk about last night, but I certainly appreciate, Joe, you sticking through this again. And like I said last night, you know, apologize to your family for me. Two nights in a row, I'm taking you to record and talk nonsense about basketball. But
you're saving them from me. They probably would say thank you to keep me away from them for another hour or so, the monster I am. So.
A leading philanthropist. But anyway, we'll get back to kind of where we started last night first off, which is one of the things that I think will be a regular topic of this podcast, especially early on as the guests are kind of more fan-centric, is just sort of Grizzlies fandom. One thing that I noticed, you know, early on when I got on Twitter, I almost immediately was using it to follow basketball. It was part of what helped me get, you know, from extreme fandom to rabid fandom, and kind of honestly progressed me from Grizzlies fandom into, you know, broader NBA obsession. But one of the things I found, because originally I was following people for information, so all the national writers, you know, as with all kind of the national NBA media, you find the ones you like and the ones you don't, and you weed out. But early on, I was here for information, and it wasn't until quite a bit later that I started following some of the more local blogs, but really other fans. And so as I followed a lot of them, one of the things that struck me was a lot of Grizzlies fans are not native Memphians. A lot of them do not live in Memphis now. And every once in a while, you definitely have people out there who really have never even been to Memphis. And so that's kind of fascinating to me. And you fall into one of those categories, actually two, in that you're not a native Memphian and you no longer are in Memphis. So kind of take us through how your Grizzlies fandom came to be. And as the listeners, like I said, you are the site manager at Grizzly Bear Blues. So obviously it got to a pretty extreme point to where we are now.
It did. It started in 2011, and I'm excited, you know, on the site on Tuesday, we announced our first video that we're doing, Moments in Grizzlery, and our series that we're doing. I've always been passionate about wanting to do an oral history of the Grizzlies, not just from a, you know, perspective of good content for the blog, and Mark King is going to help make the content great, I know, our video editor, but just from as a fan standpoint, because for me, like you said, I am not a native Memphian. I moved to Memphis in 2011, and I was fascinated when I was introduced to the Grizzlies in the spring of 2011, fascinated with their history, and I wanted to learn as much as possible about them from my watching that playoff series where they, and this is the first topic of our Moments of Gristery series, watching that Zach Randolph three make against the Spurs and that upset in that series, watching the Grizzlies push the Oklahoma City Thunder to the very brink in the Western Conference semifinals, and really seeing a team that had no business, according to every expert essentially, compete at the very highest level of basketball. So I was passionate by watching that. I'm originally from the Washington, D.C. area. I was a Wizards fan. I'm one of those fans that kind of grows up and is passionate about the fans in, or about the teams, excuse me, in the area. I'm still a big Redskins fan, even though they're awful and their name's stupid. I'm still a Capitals fan. I'm still, you know, a fan of all the local teams except for the Wizards. I kind of fell out of love with the Wizards, and I was a fan all the way back to the Rod Strickland and, you know, Mitch Richmond days. Growing up, and, you know, Gilbert Arenas, who ironically eventually becomes a Memphis Grizzly for a short time, Crittenden, Grizzlies fans are familiar with him as well, you know, the gun stuff in the locker room and all that, and that kind of turned me off to basketball, at least on the NBA level. I kind of bought into that narrative of, oh, they don't play defense, and, you know, it was just kind of my way out. So we decide, my girlfriend at the time, now wife and I, we decide to move to Memphis, and I start to try to acquaint myself with the city because I had no idea about anything about Memphis except for barbecue, which I was excited about because I like food. Justin Timberlake, who is one of the greatest musicians of our time, and Jerry the King Lawler, great wrestler. All right. So those are the things that I knew about Memphis. So I started to do research into the music scene, which is larger than Justin Timberlake, believe it or not. I started to do
Thank God
research.
Yeah.
You don't talk badly about Justin Timberlake, Chase.
If you say
no. So, but anyway, I grew up with sports. I mentioned being a DC fan, and I played football in middle school, high school, college. I played basketball in middle school and high school. Basketball was kind of my first love, and the biggest sport, or at least the team that was the most popular at that moment, because obviously the Tigers had their run a little bit earlier than 2011 with Calipari. The biggest team in that moment when I started to do my research was the Memphis Grizzlies, because they were going on their playoff run. So I watched the games, and I really kind of got caught up in the emotion of it all. Obviously, the floods were going on in Memphis at that time. You could really start to see the connection with the city and the team really, you know, fortifying. And the amazing thing to me was how organic it was. The energy felt real, and you don't really get that from an NBA arena. A great example is the Atlanta Hawks. You know, they have the great organist and all that stuff. But if you go to an Atlanta Hawks basketball game, it's gotten a little bit better in the past couple of years, I've heard. But, it, you know, there's no energy there. Same thing with the Wizards. I went and covered the Wizards game when they played the Grizzlies this year in D.C. And, you know, the energy was lacking until the fourth quarter when fans were cheering because you get free Chick-fil-A if an opposing player misses two free throws. So I was amazed by the organic energy in Memphis, the game atmosphere in the FedEx Forum. I really was impressed with how they played the game, because I am very much a physicality guy when it comes to sports. I'm a big believer that football is a collision sport within the rules, and obviously, you know, being aware of concussions and things of that nature. I'm not talking about dirty hits or bad hits, but I'm a believer in the physicality of sports. So that's why I love football. And to be honest with you, that's why I loved basketball growing up, because I believe basketball is a contact sport. And when you watch the NBA, a lot of teams nowadays, they don't necessarily believe that. But the Grizzlies in 2011 especially, they were a contact sport basketball team. And I was really fired up by the way that they played. So I decided, you know, then and there, this was going to be one of my ways that I connected to Memphis. And it really did help with that. It really opened me up to the city. It was something to kind of dive into and be passionate about. I try to be as passionate as I can in everything that I do. And, you know, and that includes my fandom of teams. So the Wizards were tossed to the wayside, and the Memphis Grizzlies became my NBA team.
Cool. Yeah, that's crazy when you said 2011, just the timeline of that. Like, it seems like yesterday, because, I mean, definitely my Grizzlies fandom increased with that 2011 run. But, I mean, I was, like, going to games and stuff back when they were, you know, playing against the Spurs in the first, you know, couple playoff runs and all that. So, I mean, 2011, that it just feels like this run is not that long. And then you realize that, you know, you've had time to go from not caring at all to where you are. It's, you know, it's been a while. I remember the floods. That's the other thing that feels like yesterday, is because I remember they would show those pictures,
right,
of intersect. It was Beal, but it was Beal like down by the river, but they would snap that picture where you could just see the word Beal with the water rising. And I just,
right,
remember my friends who had come back from college, they were all getting phone calls from their college friends who were like, are you underwater? Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, it's not like, yeah, it's Beal Street, but it's not Beal Street. But yeah, that's crazy that it was that long ago already. So that's a little bit about how Joe came to be a Grizzlies fan and now the site manager of Grizzly Bear Blues eventually. Give me a little bit on how that progressed, how you went from, I'm moving to a town, I need something to be interested in, I need a point of connection, to, okay, now I'm obsessed and eventually, you know, I'm running the largest fan blog that the, you know, the Grizzlies fan community has.
Well, as with most stories, it starts with a girl. You know, my girlfriend again at the time eventually becomes fiance, eventually becomes wife. We're sitting on the couch one day, and, you know, I'm talking to her about something with the Grizzlies. And she says, you know, you just need to start a blog. You know, I'm tired of talking about these things with you. You know, start a blog, get on Twitter or something, which she definitely regrets now, to having me, you know, get into social media a little bit. Talk about an obsession. But I started looking around at blogs, and, you know, there's other fan blogs out there, you know, Three Shades of Blue, back when they posted a little bit more consistently. You know, that was a blog that I looked into, and they did good work, and I was on their message board. But on a message board, you can't necessarily do a post. Then I came across Straight Out of Vancouver, was transitioning the Grizzly Bear Blues at the time, with Kevin Leip and Tom Lorenzo and those guys. And I, you know, started doing fan posts. You know, when we did our hiring recently, I told guys, you know, this story, and I said the story in the post that I did. You know, I was a fan poster. I did 19 fan posts before I became a writer, and I was an active commenter under the name Mulligriz. which, depending on the commenter, still on the blog to this day, sends shivers down the spines of members of the GBB community for my ridiculousness. But, you know, Mulligriz posted 19 times on fan posts, and I was active on comments, and eventually Kevin Leip, before he left to go run the Memphis Flyers Beyond the Arc blog, because Chris Harrington was leaving Beyond the Arc to go to the Commercial Appeal, before all that, or as that was all going down, before Kevin left, he brought me on as a staff writer, and the transition from Leip as site manager to Chris Faulkner occurred. And Chris Faulkner, to his credit, you know, Kevin Leip I view as a mentor, Chris Faulkner in the same way. You know, Leip taught me a lot about what it means to be a writer. Faulkner taught me a lot about what it is to take advantage of opportunity, because Faulkner saw that I was interested in doing a lot of work. Faulkner saw that I was passionate about it, and he let me essentially do what I wanted. He let me do a lot of different kinds of features. I did some things that probably caught more flack than the blog than was worth at the time, but Faulkner still let me run with it anyway. He let me start GBB Live, which is now over 3 years old, as a podcast. He let me do a lot of different things that let me kind of spread my wings, get my feet wet a little bit in terms of being a blogger. And then the time came where Chris Faulkner was going to step down because he got a new job, and the site manager job was coming open. And I thought I wanted it to be in the hands of someone who truly cared about it. Because there's blogs out there, you know, people, you mentioned people who have never been in Memphis. You know, there's blogs that are being run by people that have never been in Memphis who, you know, are, it's kind of like a stepping stone job for them. I didn't want GBB to be that, at least not while I was physically able to do something about it. So I applied for the site manager job and kind of went through a interim process with Seth Pollock over at Estimation NBA. And now I'm here, and I was named the you know, site manager period of Grizzly Bear Blues. And I think that's really cool. And you mentioned Chase being the largest fan blog. You know, I'm a very prideful person, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in, you know, if I'm going to put time into something, whether it's being a teacher, whether it's being a football coach, whether it's, you know, my hobby now that is being the site manager of Grizzly Bear Blues, I'm going to give my everything, and I'm going to make sure that I put out and our staff at GBB puts out good quality work and does what they're supposed to do. And that is something that I kind of pride ourselves on, you know, whether it's Matt Hardlicka getting to be on Chris Harrington's podcast, or, you know, I've had opportunities on the Jeff Calkins show, and I'm going to go on with Greg Gaston at a Sports 56 again this week for the trade deadline. You know, I'm passionate about giving those opportunities to the next generation of folks, the seven guys we just hired, you know, the, you know, people like Grace Baker, who's a freshman at the University of Memphis, who covers games for us. I'm interested in creating opportunities for people that I got from people like Chris Faulkner and paying it forward. So I'm a big believer in what GBB can do for people that are passionate and are willing to do the work. And that is kind of where I'm at as the site manager now. You know, it's not necessarily about me getting out as many posts as I once did, or getting to write as many features, or getting as, you know, many people's eyes on my stuff, as much as it is what is the, for the greater good of the blog. And I think that that is what it means to be a site manager. And I got that from watching Kevin Leip and from watching Chris Faulkner, and now kind of putting my own stamp on GBB.
Gotcha. So in the intro, I talked a little bit about how this definitely will not be the focus, or the focus of this will not be, you know, to really bear down on super time sensitive stuff, you know, like keeping up with what's going on in the news. That said, I want to kind of tailor the middle part. We're always going to start with learning about why the guest became a Grizzlies fan or an NBA fan. And then we're going to have a pretty standard set of questions at the end. But what I want this middle to kind of be, when it can be, is something that is sort of a topic that the guest, specific to the guest, that they have a perspective on. And it just so happens that between when we recorded the long lost episode last night and then today, that I found out Joe was doing a post. By the time you're hearing this, you'll be able to go read that post. But a little bit about Chandler Parsons and the way that fans are reacting to him currently. Obviously, there was a ton of conversation about that during the break with the whole hashtag ChanCoon phenomenon. But what I want to do, I want to let you quickly give a little bit of an introduction or a little bit of an explanation of what that piece is. But what I really want to use this to do is use it as an example and as a starting off point to a larger conversation just about kind of the way that that we talk about and discuss public figures, especially on social media and specifically on Twitter, where, you know, they may see it, they may not see it. And I think it's an interesting discussion to have. And I think the Chandler Parsons situation is kind of an interesting place to start. So tell us a little bit about what you've got in the works for that story, and we'll get into it.
Well, the article I've decided is going to be called Everybody Hates Chandler Parsons, or Everyone Hates Chandler Parsons. And that's how it feels sometimes. And, you know, the commercial appeal has put out, you know, they did their approval ratings during the All-Star break. And, you know, Chandler Parsons, the last I checked, was at a 69 disapprove, you know, 69%.
Nice.
Yeah. 69% of people disapprove of Chandler Parsons. Obviously, Jeff Calkins wrote his article in the commercial appeal, or his take five, I believe it was, his feature about Chandler Parsons, and he was wrong to post these pictures. And, you know, it was very much, and I respect Jeff a good bit, had him on GBB Live several times. I've been on his show. I just disagree with him on this, and I disagree with those 69% of people that disapprove of Chandler Parsons, because, and I do think I connect it back, Chase, to Rudy Gay. I do think that this issue with wings, and granted, I have an issue with wings. We can be honest with each other here. And on our last GBB Live, I talked with Peter Edmiston of Sports 56 about that in the Locked On Grizzlies podcast. You know, I've been burned several times by Grizzlies wings at this point, but I think it starts with Rudy Gay and the potential that was Rudy Gay. People thought he was going to be able to play and be this great player for the Grizzlies, and he just wasn't that. He's a good player. I think he's much better than Jeff Green in hindsight, at least what he was for Memphis. But, you know, he just wasn't what people thought he was going to be, and he left with a whimper. And then Jeff Green comes in after the Tayshaun Prince era, which I think Tayshaun kind of gets a pass. I'm not quite sure why. He was a pretty terrible offensive player. But anyway, he was a good defender and he was a good team leader. So that's probably part of why he gets a pass. Then Jeff Green comes in, and Jeff Green was somebody who I was pretty fired up about historically. I'm still being given a hard time about it, even a year or so later.
Yeah, I'll admit my first awareness of who you were was the Jeff Green guy. So, yeah, definitely that is the case.
Jeff Green guy, I'll take it. That's fine.
We've come a long way since then, Joe. But I'm just
we have
saying,
you and I.
My very
we
first
have.
Introduction was the Jeff Green guy.
I'm glad we've come that long way. Glad to have you on board with us here. But you know, being that Jeff Green guy and trying to buy into and being bought into what he could have been, and then you were one of the ones, Matt Hardlicka, who was with GBB at the time before you came on. He was another one who was hesitant about it at the time. And I remember us having conversations about, you know, I was for it and you were against it. And, you know, time has said that you were right and I was wrong, and it won't be the last time I'm wrong. But, you know, Jeff Green is a guy who, again, you get burned by the potential. You get burned by what might be, and he gets opportunities and he just doesn't use that potential and he doesn't achieve what he's supposed to achieve. And that eventually leads to burnout. And now teams are pretty aware of that, at least unless you're the Orlando Magic, which still gave him a $15 million contract. Now fast forward to Chandler Parsons. And I think the difference with Chandler Parsons and the reason that I have issues with people being so anti-Chandler Parsons is we have no idea who he is yet in terms of as a healthy Memphis Grizzly. I think that he gets a real bad rap despite the fact – or not thinking of the fact that he's coming back from injury. I think that people don't give that enough credit. I think that obviously he's playing very poorly. I'm not going to make an argument for him that he's actually a good player right now, because he's not a good player right now. He's not. But the basis of my article is going to be, you know, why are you taking a sample size that A, is small in the grand scheme of the contract, B, is flawed because of the injury issue, and C, you're combining those issues with the fact that he is active on social media and he says things about boobs that he probably shouldn't say. I'm not going to defend that by any stretch. But at the same time, he's posting pictures of going on trips and he's posting pictures of riding a bus to go to on a plane to go to Cancun or Chancun, as you put it. Yeah, but people are using that, and that was my issue with Jeff. People are using that as some reason to be mad at him. And I just think that's ridiculous. You can't be mad at someone for living their life in a way that you wouldn't live it. that's a public figure. And that kind of ties into what you were talking about in terms of being a public figure. Tony Allen does stuff on Twitter, or used to, now that he's had a kid, it's been a little bit more stable, but he would tweet about things and stuff that, you know, people not quite to the level of Parsons, but people, oh, this is Tony being Tony. But, you know, Parsons does stuff and he catches hell for it. And one of the issues with, oh, well, I want with Parsons was, oh, well, he's not going to work out while he's on his trip. He should be working out. The next day or two, he posts a picture on Instagram or Twitter or whatever the hell it was of him working out with his strength coach. And then in the Q&A he did yesterday, he talks about how on every trip he goes on, he brings a strength and conditioning coach to work out with him. But where is the take five about Chandler Parsons being responsible? It doesn't exist. So I'm looking for fair and balanced in a world that isn't fair and balanced. I think that Chandler Parsons, while he is not good right now, is getting a lot of crap that is not deserved. And it boggles my mind, Chase, that this is a guy who, if he's healthy and if he plays the way he's capable of, Grizzlies can make the Western Conference Finals. And that's not a crazy thing to say. Like, I'm not saying they're going to go to the NBA Finals. I'm not saying they're going to beat the Warriors, because even if Chandler Parsons was 100%, I don't think they beat the Warriors. But a healthy Chandler Parsons gives the Spurs problems, because if Parsons can go and if Parsons can play and if Parsons can shoot, now the checkmate of Kawhi on Conley is not as effective, because somebody has to defend Parsons. So if you put Danny Green on Parsons, Parsons with his size is able to cook Danny Green, which is possible if he's healthy. Now Kawhi has to come off of Conley and you get Conley back into the fold. So the checkmate that once doomed the Grizzlies is no longer there because of Chandler Parsons. But people don't see that, or they're so blinded by Chan Coon hats that they don't understand that if you want to be good, you want this guy to be good. So you blindly booing and, you know, demanding trades, that's not going to happen. Chandler Parsons is a part of this process. So you could be miserable the next 2 or 3 years if you want and hate him for who he is, or you can be a fan of the team, a supporter of the Memphis Grizzlies, and say, you know what, he's not playing well right now, but I really want him to play well because he's going to make the Grizzlies that much better if he gets to the level that he has shown the capacity to get to. Jeff Green was potential. Rudy Gay was potential. Chandler Parsons is a better basketball player when he's at his best than Rudy Gay and Jeff Green. And that has not been seen yet in Memphis. And I think people are just really jumping to conclusions about a guy who is not himself yet.
Yeah. And I agree with you on Jeff Green and Rudy Gay versus Chandler Parsons for sure. And to just dip our toe in the basketball analysis water. Yeah. I think maybe where you most saw what this was meant to be more than any other game he's played in was that 7-assist game. Cause I mean, it was just meant to have someone else who could actually handle the ball and facilitate and play make. And
sure.
It's depressing, honestly, to think about. And I'm no stranger to a good Chandler Parsons joke, but it really is truly depressing to think about what this team ought to be on the floor if he's at full capacity. But I guess what I would say, and this is kind of where I felt like I was arguing with both sides, which I think it's just like a life reality that I end up arguing with people on both sides of the same argument. But I felt like when Jeff specifically posted that, I ended up like making arguments and counter arguments, because I think I fall somewhere in the middle where, yeah, I shouldn't say there's no place. People are free to post whatever they want, but it's ridiculous the people who like just reply with like some hateful nonsense to him, or like, you know, can't wait to get your ass traded or so on and so forth. Like, that is just, it's insane. And I know that there are fans like that out there. I think I probably don't engage with or follow many of them, and so I miss a lot of that stuff. By the same token, like, all I ask if you're going that direction is just, like, be funny, or at least be trying to be funny. I think there's, like, room for good-natured is probably – that's probably too generous. But for some jokes, I guess my question to you would be, do you think that the way he is, his personality, his off-court persona – all that stuff lends itself to, you got to expect a little more in the way of people cracking jokes and taking shots at him than if he were just an average player? Or do you think even all of the sarcasm and stuff, even that stuff crosses the line a little bit?
Well, no, I think sarcasm is fine. And there's a difference, Chase. There's a difference between a good-natured joke I'm often the butt of those jokes on Twitter because I'm not very good at Twitter. Even 59,000 tweets later, I'm still not good at it. But there's a difference between a good-natured joke and, like you mentioned, the hateful, like people saying that he's not what the hell does that mean? That still drives me nuts. And maybe that would also be a good topic for this kind. What the hell does it mean to not be Memphis enough? Because I'm almost personally offended by that. Am I not Memphis enough because I would only live there for 3 years and I dress a certain way and I talk a certain way? What the hell does it mean to be Memphis enough? I don't think people understand. You talk about wanting to bring people into a city that's struggling with poverty, that's struggling with crime. You're trying to turn things around, and yet you point out people that are different than what is perceived to be Memphis, quote unquote, and you use that as a negative. And I just don't understand how you can be accepting of people and want to bring people into a place and into a community and say, oh, well, they're just not Memphis enough. And Chandler Parsons is a good example of that. He may not be Tony Allen or Zach Randolph or even Mike Conley or Marc Gasol, but that's okay. He doesn't have to be those guys as long as he's a good basketball player. And I do think that's one of the fair points that Jeff Calkins, to his credit, made throughout the process. If Chandler Parsons is shooting 40% from three and scoring 15 points a game, we're not having this conversation. None of this is happening because nobody's going to give a damn what he does in his social life as long as he's scoring and helping the Grizzlies win. Right now, he's not helping the Grizzlies win, so that makes him more of an open target. My overall point is there's reasons that he is not helping the Grizzlies win. When I would argue for Jeff Green, it would be stuff like, oh, well, he's not familiar with the scheme yet, or, oh, he is, you know, just going through a dry spell. You know, those aren't, you know, I understand why people would maybe roll their eyes at that because that's not sound logic. To me, this is sound logic. The man is coming back from knee injuries that he has had a history of in the past. If you want to be nervous about the future implications of that, go right on ahead. But there's a direct reason why he's not performing right now, and they are doing their best to get him to a place where he is going to be able to perform when they need him to. The Grizzlies are going to make the playoffs. That's going to happen. There's no question. That's 99.9% likely, barring some cataclysmic event, the Grizzlies are in. So your goal should be to have Chandler Parsons as good as you possibly can by April. That should be the goal. And I think that's what they're trying to build to, but people are not able to have that patience. And I think part of that is that's different than we've seen in the past here in Memphis.
Yeah, what I'll say on the not Memphis enough, and I think that's an interesting conversation because on one hand, I defend people's right to just like not like a player in some ways, and that boils down to a lot. I think like how much of it you see these guys as like they're on your team and so they're Grizzlies and you stand by them and true believer fan and all that stuff versus like a little bit of me, especially with a guy like Chandler Parsons, sees him as an entertainer because, I mean, when you boil it down, that's a lot of what sports are. There's very little meaning to a ball through a hoop and who has more points at the end of a game if not for the fact that we're there on our couches or in person to be entertained. So, like, I get it if people want to not be into Chandler Parsons in that way. In fact, I mean, I've done the thing where I've retweeted old tweets. I think if you would have asked me, like, who's an NBA player, I don't think I know. If you would have said, who's an NBA player you don't like, before this season happened, I would have said there's really only one, and it's Chandler Parsons. Now, not from a basketball perspective, and I always try to make clear when I'm criticizing Chandler Parsons that I was all in for this move, thought it was the best they could do, thought it was a perfect fit, all that stuff. But just from, like, you know, the way that you grow to not to dislike certain opponents, I mean, I just remember I love Dirk Nowitzki, and I remember going to a game in Dallas and saying, well, at least the Mavs are easier to dislike now that they have Chandler Parsons. So on that front, I defend it. The not Memphis enough part, it's interesting to me, and I think it'll be a big topic on a future podcast for a guest who I've already spoken to, so I don't want to burn through it too much, but I'll just say that where that gets really problematic is that what people mean when they say not Memphis enough is sort of this ethos that comes from a Zach and a Tony and this and Mark to a degree and this sort of like, because he's, you know, grew up here in some respect, but it comes from this sort of hard-nosed blue-collar idea about coming up from a tough upbringing, and that's the way that these guys mirror much of Memphis. And the people, by and large, who want to call somebody not Memphis enough, as much as they'd like to see themselves that way, and though they may be lifelong Memphians, that's not really their reality. So it's like the guy in, like, you know, the khakis and the button-down shirt with his Marc Gasol jersey tucked all the way in, who's like, that guy's not Memphis enough. And I'm just like, yeah, you don't exactly represent the things that I think you mean when you say not Memphis enough. But there's a whole lot of other issues that go into that topic. And like I said, I've got somebody that I think will be fun to really dive even more deeply into that topic. But yeah, for the most part, that's garbage, the whole not Memphis enough thing. I just
think that it really drives home you're trying to make somebody other. And what I mean by that is, for a community that should be as inclusive as possible in Memphis, Tennessee. And I lived there long enough, and I was a teacher there, and I saw the poverty, and I saw the problems. And I, you know, I'm a student of history with the Grizzlies and in general. I've seen what the purpose of that team is. For trying to be as inclusive as possible, there are really some people out there that want to force people away from a team because of an ethos. Like, and I think that's exactly fair with Zach and Tony. Guess what? Zach and Tony aren't going to be on this team 3 years from now. So what is going to be the mentality then? What's going to be your reasoning for not liking Chandler Parsons when he's still on this team in 3 years, in the last year of his deal, but Zach Randolph and Tony Allen aren't? That's going to be what does it evolve? Sure, it evolves. Are you going to evolve with it? That is what I am interested in as the Grizzlies, which are still a relatively young franchise, especially in terms of being in Memphis. As time goes on, how that, you know, mentality kind of shifts is really going to bear watching.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, like, I include myself in that to a degree, although I don't go around telling people they're not Memphis enough. But I mean, I don't exactly have my jersey tucked into the khakis or anything. But I, you know, it would be disingenuous for me to say, oh, I love the Grizzlies because, you know, of that rough and tumble mentality and the way that Zach and Tony mirror the team and came apart. Like, that, you know, that is not my reality. I don't have much in common with any of these guys, but like probably closer to Chandler Parsons in some respects than I am those other guys. So it's just kind of like picking and choosing something. And for that to be the reason you disqualify Parsons from, like, you know, being on the team or wanting to enjoy him, then yeah, that's kind of garbage. On the other hand, like I said, like, I do find it fascinating to figure out where the line is on the jokes and stuff. Cause on one hand, like, if you quote tweet Justin Bieber and make a joke, I don't think any people might be like, why are you coming into contact with a Justin Bieber tweet? But I don't think anybody's going to care and be like, that's a human being, like, freaking spare the Bieber. But, you know, with Chandler Parsons, is it different? I don't know. I mean, a lot of the times I feel like the way that we use Twitter, it's if somebody is big enough that they have so many followers and such a following that you probably, like, they may not even see your tweet or may not care, then we feel like you're like, it's fine to go ahead and fire off. And if it's somebody who, like, you might actually know a little bit, then, like, you're not going to be, like, sitting there, you know, making jokes over somebody that you feel like it might actually impact them in some way. And maybe that's not fair. I don't know. But it's interesting to me because on one hand, I like making the jokes. I think he's just kind of a ridiculous guy. He's a little bit – it's funny because we say not Memphis enough. And where do you draw the line with that? At the same time, I will say, like, Chandler Parsons, there's really no comparison for him around the league. Like, he is in a way unique, sort of in terms of his personality and, like, lifestyle off the court. A lot of that stuff, I mean, lots of guys have bold, outlandish lifestyles, but he is just kind of a different dude in a lot of respects from most NBA players. And so it's interesting because I don't think he probably cares about most of the stuff he's sees. At the other hand, like, he is a player on the team you're a fan of, and I don't know, maybe that stuff does impact him. And it's also hard to know with somebody who's more national like he is how much of it he filters in as being from hometown fans versus just national NBA fans. Because I mean, that dude, he posts one thing, like, on Instagram, and the comments are everything from sexually explicit requests to "you suck, $94 million knees." Dallas fans, like, always are like 10 responses on his about, you know, how worthless he is. "When are you going to give Dirk his money back?" is a big one. And so, like, for him, maybe it just seems like universal NBA hate, but, like, in a weird way, and again, I'm not the one to really make this point in a lot of ways, because I have and will continue to crack the jokes. But at the same time, like, I hope that, or I wonder if he feels like all the hometown fans hate him. I mean, we haven't quite gotten to, like, Nick Calathes boo him, which is gross, but booing him, like, at a home game. But I don't know. I wonder how he perceives it, if he feels like all the fans hate him. And I mean, certainly he probably sees, like, stuff, you know, that gets posted in the commercial appeal. But, you know, this is he's in a weird circumstance where this is the only team he's ever played for where he hasn't played good basketball or anything approaching good basketball, really. Like, he's never had much of a moment in front of the Grizzlies fans. So I do wonder how he perceives it all and where he's at. But I guess that's somewhat unknowable.
It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out with him. And I do think that patience is warranted. And I do think, and this will be the last note, we can move on. He is a guy, and it kind of goes into the larger point of fandom. And I think that's really an interesting part of what you're going to do with this podcast, Chase, is analyzing what it means to be a fan. To me, it's always been the name on the front means more than the name on the back. And I'm a supporter of the Memphis Grizzlies, Washington Redskins, whatever the team is that I support, that's the team that I support. I wouldn't live the life that Chandler Parsons is living. I am exhausted thinking about the things that he does in terms of his social life. But that doesn't mean I don't know Chandler Parsons. And I think that that is something that people, whenever you have idols and you put people on a pedestal, whether it's sports or entertainment, you mentioned sports is just entertainment. I agree with that. Or, you know, politics, whatever it is, you don't know these people. And I think that that is something that people really kind of get confused with. You know, you say you love Tony Allen, you say you love Zach Randolph, you say you love Marc Gasol. You love the public image of those guys. And people are very conscious of what that public image is, especially if you are a public figure. I do think Chandler Parsons kind of puts on a show a little bit to that regard and to that extent. I don't think he's dumb. I think he knows what he's doing. And I think that he hears what people are saying, and he's not necessarily going to show weakness or back down. It really is, hopefully, he starts playing better. And like I said, people will stop talking about it because he's playing well. But you know, we'll see how it goes. And I do think Parsons is a good kind of window into what it means to be a fan, because on one hand, maybe his personality traits annoy you. But on the other side, you know, if he can play, and he plays to the level, like you said, this is the first time he's really been bad for a long stretch in his entire career. If he can get right, the Grizzlies are a dangerous, dangerous team in the Western Conference.
Absolutely. So one other thing I want to do with this podcast is, since we're talking about hashtag Chan Coon, we're talking about making jokes about Chandler Parsons, I'm going to do one of the things I want to do with this podcast, which is embarrass myself as often as possible. So I'm going to play a Chandler Parsons joke I recorded in my car after tweeting with you and Peter Edmondson, and then we're going to get into the last segment of the podcast.
Oh, geez.
And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing when the jump shot would start to go in.
Oh,
and I would have liked to known you when you had working knees. Your chandel burned out long before your contract ever went.
So was that? What do you think that falls on the line? Too far?
No, I think that is hilarious, and I think that we're gonna have to go ahead. Because I know we were talking to the GBB email thread about parodies. I was a big Weird Al fan growing up, so I can write a mean parody myself. So we might have to explore a Chandler in the Wind recording. That's pretty good. I liked it. That was pretty good. That was good. That is allowed. Jokes are allowed. I think that's
all right. Well, everybody can tweet mean things at me. Like I said, that was wholly embarrassing. But I figured, hey, I loaded it. I converted the file. I'm just gonna do it. So
you
anyway,
actually had a pretty good singing voice. I'm impressed.
Oh, thanks. You know, I work really hard.
Yeah, that was good.
In the shower.
I believe it.
So anyway, this last part of the podcast we're about to go into, I need a little help, maybe from the listeners. I know that's very presumptuous to assume that we have a listener. But if you're out there, we need a name for the segment. We took some suggestions from the GBB staff on the email thread. Basically what this is going to be is a relatively set group of questions. Some of them will be rapid fire. Some of them will sink into a little bit, and we need just like some terrible pun that has to do with, basketball and questions and however you can combine those. So if you got a suggestion, and we pick your suggestion, you will have the honor of having named a segment on a podcast that no one's heard of. And there's really very few things that are more prestigious than that. So we're going to start with our yet to be named Q&A to end the podcast, and we'll go through these. The first few, I'll also say, just so I'll have the answers on record, since I'm going to ask every guest most of these questions, I'm going to go back to back with Joe and give my answers pretty quickly as we go through this. And I think it'd just be an interesting way to get to know a little bit about how each guest interacts with basketball on the whole. So we'll start off with favorite basketball player of all time.
Favorite basketball player of all time. It will probably eventually be Marc Gasol, but right now I still got to go Shaquille O'Neal. I was growing up. I was a big kid growing up. I was 6 foot. I'm 6 foot two ish, 270 pounds now. I was 6 foot two, 290 pounds when I was 13 years old. So I was bigger when I was 13 than I am now in terms of weight. But I, you know, Shaq was somebody that I looked up to, the way he played, physicality again in the post. That was me. I was the middle school Shaquille O'Neal. So I would go Shaq.
And as you know, my answer also is Shaquille O'Neal. Much like you, I probably weighed more at, 10, 11, 12 than I do now. And I'm not a light guy now, but I probably weighed more then. The only difference is I was like 5'2". So I'm 6 foot now. So anyway, it was like closer to 6 feet wide maybe. But anyway, Shaq also, because I just loved playing in the post. I loved watching Shaq dominate and always wanted to have his number any team I was on. So it was Shaq for me too. Least favorite basketball player of all time is the second question.
I'm going to go Gilbert Arenas with a close honorable mention being Gravis Vasquez. And I know it's ironic that both of them played for the Grizzlies. Gilbert Arenas, again, he kind of ruined the Wizards for me. And then Gravis Vasquez, I'm a UVA, University of Virginia, men's basketball fan, and they're struggling right now. But anyway, I'm a fan of theirs, and I was originally a fan of the University of Maryland back when they won the championship with Juan Dixon and Steve Blake, Lonnie Baxter. And then Gravis Vasquez came to the school, and I just couldn't be a fan of theirs anymore because I hated Gravis Vasquez so much. So I transferred over to UVA fandom. So Gravis Vasquez is close second, but I would go Gilbert Arenas first because he directly impacted my overall fandom of a team.
Yeah, and if you at all pay attention to Gilbert Arenas' behavior on social media now, you can feel really confident in that pick because he's just kind of terrible. I mean,
he's just
really an awful guy. Yeah, awful guy. For me, it's Kobe. I won't go into a long explanation. It's just Kobe. Just no thank you on Kobe for me.
Oh, you mean the future general manager of the Los Angeles Lakers?
Yeah, exactly. That guy. I can't wait to see what him and Magic cook up. Honestly cannot. I just hope for the Grizzlies to be part of that. Get on the phone, John Hollinger. So favorite basketball media person. This can be a writer. It could be a TV analyst. It could be a podcaster. Anyone you want, local, national, just your favorite person to hear or read about basketball.
Well, he was mean to me last night, but I'm still going to say Kevin Leip. Kevin
That's
Leip
mighty
is somebody
big.
I'm a big guy. He's somebody that I, you know, obviously looked up to when I first started writing at the blog. He's a good example of kind of advancing and expanding your own footprint, so to speak, using GBB in a positive way to get into bigger and better things for yourself. And I really just admire, you know, he gave me great advice when I started writing, you know, find your voice. And he paid me the compliment recently of, you know, me being one of those guys that has done that successfully, finding your voice as a writer, really making sure that it shines through in what you write. Matt Ardlicka is another one who I think is pretty good at that. Our GBB colleague and friend, you know, it's Kevin Leip, even though he's mean to me. I think he's an excellent writer. I appreciate the opportunity that he gave me. I would not be here without him. So it's Kevin Leip for me.
Yeah. And I'm going to save this because at one point I will drag Kevin Leip onto an episode of this podcast. However, I have, fun fact, known Kevin Leip since I was in fifth grade, and probably didn't speak to him again until the last couple of years. But I've got a couple Kevin Leip stories that him and I have discussed, but one that he probably doesn't even remember. I guess he was more a more memorable kid than I was. But yeah, I've got a couple Kevin Leip stories. But and we'll talk a little bit about basketball Twitter and the interactions. But I mean, honestly, I think it's cool. I did not know that would be your answer. You know, before yesterday. But I mean, knowing what I know of you and what I know of Kevin, and I know you both a little bit, beyond just like the surface of regular Twitter, but I mean, you guys are pretty different guys in your styles and method when it comes to attacking the whole Grizzlies blogging thing. So I mean, it's a cool answer. 'Cause like I said, pretty different in terms of style.
Oh, definitely. We're completely opposite. And I think Matt Hardlicka, who's a guy who I, you know, obviously is a staff writer with us, you know, he's another guy that as a writer I look up to, you know, because those are people that, like you said, different styles, different ways of approaching it. But I can appreciate that. And I think that kind of goes into the larger sense of what we were talking about with Chandler Parsons. Like, I may not have lived the life that Chandler Parsons chooses to live, but I'm going to appreciate the skill that he has. Same thing with Kevin and Matt. I may not do things the way that they do it, but that doesn't mean that I can't look at it and say, wow, that's really good. And, you know, with Kevin, coupling that on with, again, advancing, coupling that with being the guy who gave me my start, that's why it's light for me.
Gotcha. For me, it is also a Kevin, probably Kevin Arnovitz. I think of all the national guys, first of all, he's just a great writer. I love listening to him on different podcasts he appears on. So he's interesting, an interesting guy. But also, I think he probably most closely aligns to what I find the most interesting about the NBA. And he's really kind of found, I think, intense interest in, well, for one, what he calls palace intrigue. One thing he said a couple of years ago, things have calmed down considerably, but, you know, when we were going through all of the craziest part of the para experience, I think it was, and he mentioned that, you know, if you put the dysfunction going on in Memphis at that time in an LA or New York, I mean, it would be the biggest story in the NBA. So I'm into all that. I appreciate people who are like, I'm just here to watch the basketball. I don't need all the external stuff. I love the external stuff. I like KD and Westbrook drama. I like front ownership dysfunction. I don't particularly like it in the middle of my team per se, but I enjoy. And then one other thing he's really good on is the business of the NBA. And I love that stuff. It was really interesting to me. It was exciting to me when I did the story earlier this year for GBB to get to talk to Jason Wexler, because that whole side of it, there's, to be successful in Memphis is an extreme challenge on the business front. And it is tethered so tightly to the basketball side that in certain ways that it's not in other markets. And so Arnovitz is actually one of the guys that, you know, has talked about the things about Memphis that are unique. Of course, we like to think that we're unique because we either live here or we're fans of the team and we all love Memphis, and that's great. But it's hard to really know how much of that's legit, because you emotionally – you want to believe that's true. But to hear somebody like him talk about the way that Memphis is revered around the league on the business side for the way they've connected themselves to a market. And honestly, if you're analyzing team construction and things like that, you really can't untie that from the business side in Memphis, because a lot of what they have to consider as they're moving forward is they're sinking resources on top of resources into this team. And so when you look at, should Memphis think about breaking it up? They're never going to get above, you know, the four seed at the rosiest. And people who are outside of the NBA or outside of Memphis who are NBA fans might think you're not going nowhere. You know, get as many picks as you can for Marc Gasol, trade Mike Conley, da, da, da. But they're looking at this from, we can't be hemorrhaging money, and we have a version of this team that the city is connected with. And so I find all that stuff fascinating. I try to find out as many things as I can about what's going on with season ticket sales and all that kind of thing. And so for that, Kevin Arnovitz, beyond that, he's just a really cool guy. So that would probably be my answer. And that was way too long-winded. But anyway.
No, we'll, I thought it was a good answer. He's pretty good. But he's another guy, you know, I would say with my writing, I'm more along the lines of a Jeff Calkins or, you know, someone like that. A little bit more column-based, you know. Those analytical guys, I try to dip my toe into that every once in a while. I like Arnovitz. He's pretty solid.
Yeah. Favorite basketball movie?
Favorite basketball movie is Hoosiers. Hoosiers is terrific.
Yeah, you already know I haven't. I haven't seen Hoosiers.
I might send you a VHS of Hoosiers.
All right. I guess I'll go White Man Can't Jump. That's always kind of been my standard answer, but there was a podcast on The Ringer recently about it, and it's like one of those things I probably haven't seen it in like 5 or 6 years, so I feel like I need a revisit to make sure. But favorite NBA moment from your team? Your team in this case is the Grizzlies. So favorite Grizzlies moment?
Favorite Grizzlies moment. That would be when the Grizzlies eliminated the Los Angeles Clippers, the Z-Bo ejection, skipping out of the, you know, FedEx Forum, whoop that clip, and all that stuff was at its peak. And, you know, it was really awesome to see the Grizzlies reach that level of success and have, you know, 18,119 people leave in euphoria and excitement, and everybody kind of funnels out into Beale Street. And there's a bar on Beale Street called Alfred's, and it's a two-level bar, has an outdoor deck and an up-top deck on the first and second floor. And we were up on the second floor, and it was us and a group, my wife and I and a group of friends. And we were sitting there, you know, kind of watching Beale Street people, you know, celebrating the win. And that's a great view. If you've never been up there, I highly recommend it. Go visit Memphis. It's a terrific city. And I enjoy that view. And it was one of those moments that I'll never forget, because it was like, yeah, this is home, you know, and that's something that was really important for me coming from Virginia, never having left Virginia before I came to Memphis, you know, and I had already made connections to the city, obviously, with friends and, you know, good times. But that was one of those moments that you have that you're like, yeah, I'll always remember this, not necessarily because of the win, but because of the people I was with and because of the city itself and the energy and the positivity and just, you know, it was really a really good night. So for me, it would be that clinching game against the Clippers and then enjoying it afterwards. That would be the best moment for me.
Yeah, that's a close. That was number two for me. Number one is game six. Probably if I had to narrow it all the way down to like a single play, it's probably the three that Zebo hit game six when we upset the Spurs. That season was the last one where I haven't either had season tickets or pretty easy access to season tickets in one way or another. But in that season I had, you know, I didn't have any kind of season tickets, didn't have any way to get tickets to the game. And I remember a couple of friends who were into the Grizzlies, one who had always been a huge NBA fan. I was on the Memphis Tigers message board, which really makes it feel like a long time ago, because I really try to stay away as far away from college sports as possible now. But at the time I was an obsessive Tigers fan. I wasn't, you know, not been that long since I had graduated, only about a year or two. And so I was always on the Memphis Tigers message boards. And I remember going into one section of them, and one of the ticket reps at the Grizzlies posted a discounted link, which is hilarious to think now. We were in a playoff situation and there were still tickets to be had, like I'm assuming a couple days before, at a discounted price. But I remember, you know, texting a couple of friends and saying, hey guys, maybe we should do it. And so they were pretty good seats. You know, we weren't paying through the nose. And so we went to the game, and there's something about, I'm sure winning a championship is great. I haven't really experienced it with a team, at least not at an age where I could, you know, fully appreciate it. But, I think one of the most remarkable things as a fan is when your team pulls a real upset, like a true, there was no chance going in. I mean, you think back, I mean, I say people forget, but maybe they don't. But I mean, before that series, the Grizzlies had never won a playoff game, period.
Right.
So the thought of winning a series against the top seeded San Antonio Spurs, I just like even going into that game six, even though the statistical likelihood of winning had probably pushed into our favor by that point, if you've got a clinch, you know, the opportunity to clinch a series at home, that's probably the case. But I mean, I just never believed it was going to happen. For people who know me, I can be a little pessimistic about my own teams probably. So I was just like, you know, we'll go just in case, but this is probably going to be deflating. And then just as those shots hit, and especially as he hits that three, you start to think this is going to happen. Like this is real. And so for me, that was just like kind of the spark that sent, you know, all of this into motion, and an awesome memory for sure. And peak Zebo, which was just a whole nother thing, as well as he has maintained his offensive game to this day. Those first couple of years were just like, I mean, unbelievable, the stat lines he was putting up. So that would be mine.
Solid one. Super Zebro's fun. And that's one of the subjects of our first, you know, Moments in Gristory video series. So hopefully folks will chime in and post their videos about that.
Awesome. All right. Next one is about your personal, and this will be in heavily quotation marks for me especially, and I assume for many of our guests, but it's, did you play basketball specifically at any level? It can be pickup, it can be high school basketball. Maybe we'll have some guests who have played college. Maybe one day we'll have a guest who has played or plays in the NBA. But any from your whole quote-unquote playing career, it can be as young as you'd like or as old as you'd like, what is your favorite personal basketball achievement or moment?
Well, I played in middle school and in high school, and it stopped with my freshman year playing basketball in high school. I stopped growing. I was 6'2", and I stayed 6'2", and I realized football was going to be my sport, at least when it came to college. Not many 6'2" centers out there. But my peak moment in terms of basketball was that eighth grade year. Like I mentioned earlier, I was essentially Shaq, and I had made an all-star game. And I was playing in the All-Star game, and the stands were relatively full for, you know, watching 13 and 14-year-olds play basketball. And, you know, I kind of shoot a Marc Gasol elbow jumper, and I get fouled, and I do like a backward somersault after I get fouled, and the shot goes in, you know, and everybody cheers, and they have my arms are up, and it was kind of the closest I'd ever been to feeling like an NBA player, not in terms of being good, but in terms of, you know, like people cheering and making an and one and all that stuff. That's my favorite moment from playing. I still play pickup now, and we talked about this a little bit on the first recording. My favorite thing about playing pickup, I would say even more than the eighth grade memory, is whether it's, you know, when I'm by myself and I just jump into a game, or whether, you know, in high school and college, I would meet up with some buddies and we'd go play up at the gym. I like the solitude and the competitiveness of the game. You know, when I'm by myself, just me and the ball and the hoop and being able to dribble and shoot, you know, and then when I'm playing, you know, you're kind of in the zone and you're focused, and it's an opportunity to kind of turn your brain off. You know, some people really like to dive into a good book. Some people like to go to the movies. You know, so for me, it for a long time, it was playing basketball because it was a chance for me to kind of turn off my brain from whatever was going on in the world, relationships, work, whatever, and, you know, just go play for a couple of hours and just focus on the game and trying to play the way that you're capable of and, you know, do what you want have to do to win. And, you know, I really liked that. So for me now as an adult, it's really about that opportunity to kind of clear my head, be a part of, you know, a game that I have been playing since I was 5 years old. And, you know, basketball is different than football. Football, you need pads, you need equipment. You know, you can play flag football pickup games, but that's, you know, that's how knees get blown out. You know, you can play a game of basketball and it not be that intense in terms of injury potential. So for me, basketball is something that can stay with me as I age. And that's one of my favorite things about it, is it's a lifelong kind of game that I can play.
Cool. Running a little long. I love a long podcast, but I know not everyone does. So I'll try to tell mine really quickly. Basically, sixth grade, I try out for the basketball team. My life in terms of athletics would, for the next several years, just be a series of the football coaches trying to explain to me that I would have that I was more built for football than basketball, and me saying, no, thank you. But the truth of it was, I was just like a super fat kid, which we alluded to earlier, just really robust. And so being at this point, waiting for that next growth spurt, kind of a short fat kid, I tried out for the basketball team. The coach essentially said, you know, you got some good skills there. Come back next year, try as hard as you can to be not so fat. And so, you know, I took that fat shaming and I just went back to church basketball where I belonged anyway. And in sixth grade, there was two church teams at my church and the other one was really awesome. And ours was like just okay. And the coach from the other team said, hey, I want to put our team in a competitive tournament, but we want to pull three guys from your team to play with us. And so we kind of like combined the two teams. We get to the tournament. I don't remember if we won a round or two or what, but our second or third game, I think, was against my middle school basketball team that had cut me and fat shamed me. And so I remember we went to overtime, this little church league team against an actual school. And in the overtime, with under a minute left, there was a loose ball. I dove on the floor, wrestled the loose ball away from one of the guys I went to school with, and we ended up winning by 4 points in overtime. So that easily is my number one basketball memory.
I think that's a good one. I think it's always good when you can prove somebody wrong. That's nice.
Absolutely. Oh, and they had like t-shirts made up with like Goldberg's tattoo on them that said, who's next? It was, they were the worst. Anyway, we shut them down. All right. Next one is, what is one thing specifically about NBA Twitter that you love?
I love the community. I love the community aspect to it. I think people kind of rally behind each other. An example that I used on our last show that we recorded was, Jay Siskin, one of the editors over at GBB, was having a family issue, and you know, people kind of rallied to him and helped with him. Twitter handle Scalded is another example. Somebody who was having issues with family stuff and, you know, kind of helping him out. It really is something that's unique about blogging that I never really realized, you know, whether, you know, Chase getting to know you, or, you know, Matt Ardlicka we talked about, or Andrew Ford, who doesn't write for GBB as much anymore. You know, folks that I consider, you know, people that I would want to, you know, hang out with, you know, friends. I never thought I would get that out of blogging and out of Twitter and things like that. And that's real. And I think that that is, you know, in the 21st century, a real unique thing is that you can have people that you do feel a connection to, you know, whether it be the Grizzlies themselves or whether it's working on the blog together or whatever it may be. And you may never meet that person and you may still think, you know, I like that guy, you know, but you've never met that person. And it really is unique. But I like that. I like that you can make that connection because I feel like it's more pure. You know, it's not based off of, you know, if you're a guy meeting somebody like some girl or something like that or vice versa. You know, there's no ulterior motives. There's, you know, I'm just a fan of a team and you're a fan of a team and we write on the blog together or we tweet about it. I really like the community aspect of it and how people can kind of get to know each other through that specific lens. And sometimes that eliminates, you know, maybe some other things that would lead to you not being friends, but you can be a little bit more connected because of that real focus on one aspect of your personality.
Yeah. Mine is similar. For me, I think my favorite part is, and really probably the only reason I still have a Twitter account because, recent world events have led me to many moments where I'm like, this has become just on the whole too overwhelming and I would like to delete the whole thing altogether. But beyond that, the cool thing for me and why I continue to stick around for sure is that I honestly do not have many, if any, friends here in Memphis, at least, that are real life friends who love the NBA. Definitely, I would say none who love the NBA. A couple who are like, you know, casual Grizzlies fans, but, you know, nobody who feels about the Grizzlies the way we feel about the Grizzlies, and definitely no one who is like checking out League Pass on a random Tuesday. And so, like, my friend group in terms of basketball really is the people that I interact with on Twitter to a large degree. And, you know, I've become friends with what I would consider friends with a lot of people through basketball Twitter or Grizzlies Twitter. And I shouldn't leave my mom out. She'd probably be mad. My mom is a rabid NBA fan and very likely to text me if, like, the Hawks and the Bucks are going into overtime on a random weeknight. So love you, Mom. But beyond my mom, who, again, is obsessed with the NBA, I really just don't have people here who, like, want to sit around and watch a game. So that's what I'm doing with people on Twitter. And my friends who care nothing about basketball and most of them nothing about sports think that it is really bizarre. I know one night last year, Matt was in town. Matt heard Look at Who You referenced, and we went to dinner, and they thought that was beyond strange. And we're like, do you need us to go with you? Are you sure you're okay? And,
right.
You know, they had their jokes. But, no, I mean, there's, like, a real connection that you feel more connected to the team. And, like I said, it's just people to hang out and watch basketball with, even if it's on Twitter. So that's probably my favorite thing. We'll skip the least favorite thing in the interest of time because we're just positive guys. Just going to keep it positive, and we're going to go to the last question. And that is, what is the non-sports thing that you consider yourself the biggest fan of? And the way I'll define this, as we ask our guests this, is fandom for me is something you love and you engage with it beyond that thing itself. So maybe you own memorabilia, maybe you enjoy reading analysis of that thing, maybe you engage in the fan culture in some way, you know, anything from like a message board or like you're part of a subculture of Twitter about that thing the way we are Grizzlies. That's one great indicator. Another would be something you find yourself defensive about it when people criticize it, maybe even irrationally. So what would be that for you, the non-sports thing you consider yourself the biggest fan of?
For me, it's professional wrestling, and it's something that, you know, despite my wife's best efforts, I'm still a fan of. It's a lifelong thing. We talked about lifelong love of basketball. Pro wrestling is the same thing. You know, my first memory is when I was 2 years old and I was playing on a sidewalk in New York and New Jersey when we lived up there. I believe it was New Jersey at the time because we spent a year in one and a year in another. But anyway, I'm on a sidewalk and a kid comes up to me with four random wrestling figures. It's King Kong Bundy, Hulk Hogan, Macho Man Randy Savage, and Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man. And he sits down on the sidewalk with me. He's a couple years older than me. And we're playing with the toys and all that stuff. And then he gets called by his mom or whatever, and he leaves. And he leaves the figures with me. And, you know, I still had those till an age that I'd rather not say on the air because it's embarrassing. But it was definitely past high school. I'll leave it at that. But it was, you know, they were memorabilia. And that when you asked that question of me earlier on when we were talking about the show, that's what made me think pro wrestling, because it wasn't like I played with them when I was 20 years old. I just kept them because they were a memory. They were memorabilia. And whether it's, you know, I don't watch it religiously, but I do follow a blog that kind of keeps, you know, has recaps of the shows, and I follow along with that, and I watch the pay-per-view still, and every, you know, I have a WrestleMania party every other year on average or something like that, you know, have people over and just watch WrestleMania. And it's something that I am defensive of because I think that wrestling fans, kind of like Chandler Parsons, get a bad rap. And especially in today's day and age, people, I realize it's fake. That's not the point. I completely get that the outcomes are predetermined. They do shows 250 times a year. If they were actually fighting, they would be dead. Every single one of them would be dead if it was real because they do it 250 times. So clearly it's not real. The ring's padded. I get all that. But I can appreciate the athleticism that these guys show and the feats of strength that they do. And I can appreciate the entertainment value. I can appreciate the showmanship. And a guy like Vince McMahon, I can appreciate, who I don't think gets enough credit in terms of impacting American culture. You know, you watch the NBA All-Star Game, The Weeknd, for example, and they do the introductions. Vince McMahon was doing that stuff with technology and big intros, elaborate intros 20 years ago. Lady Gaga propelling down from the ceiling of the Super Bowl this year. Shawn Michaels did that in 1996 at WrestleMania 12. I'll never forget that as long as I live. These are things that, you know, Vince McMahon will never get credit for because of the personality he is, but to take something as niche as wrestling, which was looked essentially as like carnival folk back in the, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s, to take it from that and to make it this national and global brand that is a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, that is remarkable. And I think that that really needs to be paid respect to. And I think that that's more than just, you know, a bunch of dumb people that think it's real enjoying it. I think that there's a real entertainment value to it. And it's a testament to what those wrestlers do on a day-to-day basis. And it's also a testament to what Vince McMahon and his staff has done to make it relevant, despite the fact that it's clearly not real competition. So to me, it's professional wrestling, and it's really evolved as I've gotten older. When I was a child, of course, I cheered for Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and those guys because I thought it was real. But once you realize, kind of like Santa, and sorry, spoiler alert, Santa's not real, and Easter Bunny, you know, that's kind of how
I got to put a warning on the podcast.
Yeah, sorry about that. So that's kind of, you know, I looked at pro wrestling like that. Okay, it's not real, but I can still appreciate the emotion. I can still appreciate the value of it. And that's kind of how I look at wrestling even to this day. So for me, it's pro wrestling.
Gotcha. I was super into pro wrestling as a kid. It didn't really stick for me, but there was an adult who shall not be named when I was about 11 years old, who the pay-per-view went out on the TV, a huge storm, and we're racing to a different person's house, and they hit another car, screamed, "I can't miss Goldberg," and drove on to the house. So it wasn't like a bad wreck. They just barely hit the other car. Everybody was fine. So anyway, but yeah, that's my biggest wrestling memory, but loved it as young. So I don't mind you defending that one. For me, I thought about Hamilton because Hamilton is coming to the Orpheum in the 2018-2019 season. Love musical theater. Get your tickets. But if I'm answering honestly, biggest fan of, will surprise no one, it's Parks and Recreation. Love Parks and Rec for a whole lot of reasons. It's my favorite television show of all time. Highly recommend it. The part of this that really hits for me in terms of how you describe fandom, yeah, I do engage with it in other ways. I've read way too much, you know, different reviews of episode by episode criticism and things like that. I've, you know, read Amy Poehler's biography and all that kind of stuff. But the part that really gets me is the, what would you be defensive, or do you find yourself defensive of it? And I remember on the day that the final episode, the series finale of Parks and Rec aired, that I was on Twitter, and a lot of people on Twitter like Parks and Rec, and so people were bouncing back different memories and talking about how much they love it and so sad to see it go and on and on and on. And I remember this one person who I really liked and seemed like a completely nice individual. I remember that they posted, "I see everyone is talking about Parks and Rec today, never got what the big deal was," something to the effect of, "Why didn't everybody just shut up about it?" And the finale of Parks and Rec aired on February 24th of 2015. And I refollowed that person on Twitter after unfollowing them for their comments. I refollowed that person on Twitter, I want to say about 2 months ago. So I held a real grudge over the hate towards Parks and Rec, but absolutely love it. I could go on about that for an entire podcast's worth, but that is definitely my answer.
I think that's a good one. And Parks and Rec is a show, I wasn't a fan of it when it was on television, but I got introduced to it through Netflix. And my wife and I, that's our favorite show. It's one of the few shows in our relationship that we've agreed to watching together. So we may actually go back to just rewatching Parks and Rec because we can't find anything else that we like to watch together. So I think we go back to just restarting Parks and Rec.
Hey, that's always a good decision. The world needs some Leslie Knopes, especially now. So never a bad decision to sink into some Parks and Rec and go live in Pawnee for a little while. This has been You Like Hoops. Like I said, things will evolve and change, and I appreciate you listening and sticking with us. Go ahead and send any comments that are not mean, nothing beyond the level of a sarcastic Chandler Parsons joke. But any suggestions you've got, send them on to me on Twitter. I'm at Deep Fried Couch. Joe, your Twitter handle is?
At Joe Mullinax, just the name.
At Joe Mullinax. Easy to remember. So anyway, you can also send suggestions if you want to help name the question and answer session that comes at the end there. And we will hopefully have a new episode with you with a brand new guest in the next couple of weeks. Thanks for listening.